Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, people are now going through what I went through as so young that people, many friends of mine now, their parents are either died or they're going through into dementia or goodness knows what. And you know, people are so panicked about it and how it overtakes the life and how difficult it is to look after. But sort of one day at a time. And the best thing you can do, of course, if you know somebody who is a caretaker, is to offer them a day to look after, to let them get out of the house and go and be sit with the person who's not well and not be frightened of that, to do that, to keep an eye on somebody, give them some freedom, because that's the thing that I found the most difficult when I were times when I was completely on my own with my mother for days on end. And I mean, I had help at different times. Of course, I had to, because I wasn't there. But there were many periods where I didn't have. And that's where you can help in that situation.
That was Jacqueline Bissett. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is Talk Easy. Welcome to the show. Everyone. I want to apologize for the delay in today's episode. I have been infected once more with some kind of sickness, as you can hear in my voice. But we only have two more episodes left in the year, and our last two are so lovely and perhaps random to some of you. But neither guest has ever done a podcast before. So this week, it is with the wonderful Jacqueline Bissett, and next week we will end this year's show with Keith David. But for today, I have a feeling you know who Miss Bissett is, and it is pronounced Bissett, not Bissett, and she made clear of that when we sat down earlier this week. She is a wonderful, wonderful actress who got her start in the 60s and has pretty much consistently worked since then. She has collaborated with everyone from George Cukor to Roman Polanski, Francois Truffaut, John Huston, so many wonderful, wonderful directors. The biggest titles you have unquestionably seen her in, Bullet, Day for Night, Casino Royale. She has been in so many movies that are landmark pieces of cinema that sitting down with her for an hour is such a joy, because it's just a history lesson in film. Most recently, she is in a new film called Asher. It stars Richard Dreyfuss and Ron Perlman. And here's a bit from the trailer.
Avi sent down another job for you.
You and a couple of guys.
What is it you do for a living?
I'm a contractor.
What kind of contracts?
Three jobs.
I need someone I can rely on. I need someone with history. We have history.
What happens in our business when you get too old?
Well, there's no retirement home for us.
Did you ever think about doing something else?
What if I told you I wanted to take you out of here right now?
We can have a future together.
I just killed a man in the bathroom. I'm afraid if we don't leave right now, they're going to call the cops.
Does that happen to you a lot?
Anyway, if you've been a fan of Miss Bissett's work over the years, like I have, if you like Day for Night especially, I think you will enjoy this episode. It was an absolute honor. And conversations like this one with someone like Jacqueline Bissett, you know, the show is really, really hard to do every week for a whole bunch of different reasons. And conversations like this make it worthwhile. Makes me smile, actually. So I'm sitting outside. It's Sunday morning, and I'm excited for you folks to take a listen. So, have a good week, and here, finally, is Jacqueline Bissett.
Something that I found really fascinating, you are born in 1944, and in the early 60s, your career starts to take off, somewhere around 64, 65, I believe.
Well, I did my first small kind of extra part in 65.
Right, and then you do Polanski's film in 66.
No, I think it was 65.
65 also, okay.
I think so.
Good. We have to be about facts in this day and age because...
I think it was 65.
I also saw that at the time, you know, I was curious, what was it like to feel as if your desire to be an actor was coming to fruition at that age?
Oh, I didn't consider myself an actor at all at that point. It took me a long time before I would even use the word I'm an actor.
What would you say to people when they're like, what do you do?
I'd say I do some acting.
You do some acting?
I do some acting.
Right.
And I was, there's two words that were very frightening to me. One was actor and one was the word artist, which I feel it gets misused and I feel you have to earn it.
Okay. And you didn't feel like you had earned it at that point?
Oh, I certainly hadn't earned anything at that time. I was very young and I had no formal training and I had a very clear view of what I thought an artist was. And it would mean years of working in a certain direction and developing a craft and a point of view and a freedom and an honesty.
Which you feel takes years to find.
Well, no, you could have it, not years necessarily, but I mean, within my own personal life, I felt, yeah, I have to do some groundwork and have knowledge and develop your culture and have a point of view. Because I think when people, sometimes in conversation, somebody, maybe they're talking about a play or a film or something, and somebody says, this is a piece of whatever, rubbish, and you feel a reaction, which is anger, which they say, they wipe it out from, they take it out of the world as if it's rubbish, and you say, well, I'm sorry, but who are you? You know, what have you done to say this is rubbish? Who are you? What makes your opinion, why are you spouting your opinion?
Right.
And it used to anger me. Now, the fact that I might have the same reaction used to make me question, why do I have the right to say what if this is good or not good? Okay, you like or you don't like. I don't mind people saying I don't like it or everything, but when people say this is rubbish, that used to anger me and still does, because to do any piece of work, really, really good work, takes a lot of all aspects of life. And so
I feel like even bad work takes a lot of energy.
Totally.
It's all so draining.
It's draining and it involves personal commitment. And people don't set off to do bad work. So, and I used to imagine New York cafes, and I'd say, There's all these people who are very hip, trendy, blah, 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 all sitting around criticizing everything. That's the modus operandi. Right. Criticize everything that comes out as if you've seen it, you've wiped it out, you love it, you don't like it. And they used to annoy me. I thought, I don't aspire to that. On the contrary, I don't aspire to that.
Mm. There's something you said in an interview from about, I think, 15 years ago that I was struck by, which is that you were in the beginning stages of your career, and maybe even now, a little trepidatious about auditions, but that you felt at a young age you had an understanding of life, an experience, because you said, but I felt I had a certain degree of knowledge about life, which was really odd at that time, not about my life, but about life. I was quite responsible, probably because I was looking after my mother. I'd already been looking after her for 5 or 6 years by that time. I was interested in your sort of early development. You had to become an adult maybe before most people do. Is that fair?
Probably, yeah, probably. Mm.
How did that help you in terms of creating something honest in art at that age?
Well, I don't know if I did. I mean, I didn't. I'm not saying that I did create anything art. I just I had enough modesty, I suppose, to not think that I was going to be doing anything great. And I was, you know, we all have instincts about ourselves. My friends would tell me that I was wise beyond my years, and I didn't know why, but I had a kind of a wisdom. I really don't know what to say to these questions because ask me another question and we'll come back to it.
Okay. I was going through, I know you have talked about Day for Night probably too many times,
mm-hmm.
but you have to understand, as someone who is obsessed with movies and is making them myself, although not as well as Francois, that film has meant so much to me for so long. And at that time when you got that role, I know the whole story of you dancing and them coming to find you and the agent not answering.
Yeah.
It's a really wonderful story. I want to go back. When you first got news that you were going to do this, how did that make you feel? Because I know French cinema and Italian cinema was so important to you growing up.
Well, it felt made me feel, what's the word when you've been... It kind of confirmed my existence.
Validated,
yeah. And surprised, really, really surprised, because of it. I was very conscious of his world, but I couldn't imagine that he could be conscious of anything that I'd done. And when I did finally ask him what he'd seen me in, he told me he'd been in some cinema, near some cinema at some point in south of France. I don't know what he was doing there, but he'd seen me in a film where I played an amphetamine addict. I was a little taken aback. And one other film, which had no resemblance to what he asked me to do. I thought, wow, I came into somebody's conscience, and that was him. That was mind-blowing.
Mm.
He would talk about actors with great enthusiasm, certain actors, not necessarily ones I particularly admired, but he would talk about them. No, he would talk about them with great reverence. Certain actors. And I didn't know what drew him to those particular actors.
What's making you recall that?
What's making me recall it?
Yeah, recall that he would talk about actors with certain reverence. Is that sort of the memory you have?
Well, no, it's just another thing that I haven't spoken about. I'm just thinking I'll give you the same old conversation that you've heard and read in 10 interviews. No, I just, that was something new, the thought that came.
Yeah.
So something surprising for me, when he had great reverence for Hitchcock, of course,
right,
and Jean Renoir, and
sometimes people surprise you though, because I remember reading something where Stanley Kubrick said his favorite movie is this film called The Jerk with Steve Martin, which is a lovely movie. But I remember reading that as a kid and being like, "What, really? Of all the things, Stanley Kubrick's favorite film." Is this like kind of...
light film.
Yeah, a light film.
Mm.
Had you noticed that? And you've worked with so many people. I was thinking, when you think back on Francois, is there something he taught you or something?
Oh, he taught me a lot. He said to me, "You're a very realistic actress." He said, "I'm not particularly interested in realism. And I want you to just do as I say and don't question it. Just do it, you know." And there were moments during the shooting of Day for Night where I felt very muddled because combination of trying to speak French, which I didn't speak, and these sometimes unattached directions that seemed to, I felt extremely awkward, self-conscious, and I did exactly what he said, and I tried to get it into without being questioning and finding motivations and stuff. And when I saw the film, I was absolutely enchanted by what it did. It wasn't real, but it was totally effective.
Right. But I think you do come across in that film as the sort of anchor, the emotional anchor of the piece. I do feel like you have you almost ground the film in some sort of reality, even though you're like this big movie star coming in and there's paparazzi.
I don't know.
There's something about, especially your relationship with, I think he was a therapist. Is he a therapist? He's a doctor of some kind.
My husband.
He's your husband, yeah.
Oh, he was wonderful, that actor. He was just wonderful. He was wonderful looking with blue eyes.
So stunning.
Stunning. And the way he looked at me, those few little shots, those moments of great reassurance. And I thought, and then later when I think back, I think, golly, this silly woman I was and had this silly little sexual affair with this young actor when I was married to such a wonderful person who understood me so well. But it was a silliness, but it served the film at the time. In that situation, I was ashamed in some part of me in the character. I was.
But it's a character.
I know, but I still thought, what a silliness I am in that character.
Can I ask you a larger question? At that age, at that point, how did you feel about yourself as an actress? Did you feel like that character at all?
No, I didn't feel like it. And when... obviously, he had this image of me because he asked me to bring my movie star wardrobe with me. And I said, a movie star wardrobe? That is the antithesis of the way I lived and worked and in Hollywood. I lived in I lived on the beach in a little, what was an originally a converted packing crate for a grand piano.
So not movie star Hollywood.
No, and it was tiny, tiny, tiny. And I lived there with an actor. And I had those sort of hippie dresses that were... long hippie dresses, and I was always cooking and trying to get the sand out of my hair, and it was the exact opposite. And so when he said, bring your movie star wardrobe, I said, Lord above, what do I do? Where would I even find it? And the shops were awful in LA at the time. There was nothing very really glamorous. There was showy stuff, and there was...
This is the early 70s.
Yes. There was one shop which had European clothing, and it was called Charles Gallet. And I thought that would be the only place that I could think of, that I knew of. There probably were others, but I didn't know of them, where I might find. So I went there and I bought three outfits. And I knew that he had conservative taste. I knew it wasn't, I'd been told that, or read somewhere. Mm-hmm. So when I arrived with them, he actually liked all of them. But I had never spent so much money in my life probably.
Did the film pay you back for the dresses?
No, they didn't, no. No, but they used them all, which was something.
Good.
So that was and I was very interested in getting that right. I did not want to, I didn't know what he thought of as a, because they weren't movie star dresses. They were nicely well-cut clothes, but they were not whatever he meant, I seem to have got it. But the person who had movie star clothes was Valentina Cortese, who had the most incredible clothes I have ever seen in my life. She actually had a lady's maid traveling with her.
Of course.
To do the ironing and these incredible pleated satin, chiffon, exotic, incredible clothes with jewels and scarves she put over her head. And she was so elegant and so Italian and amazing. She was just amazing. I saw the film fairly recently and I saw her and I thought, gosh, I was probably about that age that she must have been when she did the film. Now that I am, or I'm older now than she was at that time, but I tried to put it in context with what she gave to the film, which was a wonderful quality she had. Mm. So I think she's still alive.
Is she really? Was the making of the movie as joyous as the final product? Was like, was that the
well, it was,
design
it was
of
quite
it?
Fun, but it was, you know, I think it was pretty fun, but it was also, for me, it was, as I didn't speak French, it was a constant anxiety, and if he changed a word in the dialogue, I was really sweating.
Which he did a lot, right?
No, he didn't, because I warned him. I said, you can't change the words. So you give me, decide on them and give them to me at least 2 days before, because I'll mess it up.
Mm.
And just to, but the biggest thing that probably calmed me down is he said, because I was going, you know, I was going bonjour sometimes, you know, getting so nervous. So he said, no, you're not French in the story. You don't mm-hmm. have, you can make mistakes.
Right.
I said, oh, right.
Yeah, you have a sort of out.
Took it off my shoulders and just, I relaxed.
Here's one way I think it seems like you're similar to that character. You have this interview in 1982 with Roger Ebert, which is really, I think, the best piece of writing about you and your work, and in a lot of ways. I don't know if you remember this, but it was in 1982 in Chicago. And you said, I find that I have an intense obsession with making films. I not only love to make films, I perhaps need to make films. And I think that character is a little similar in that way. She's willing to do anything for the production of the movie.
I don't know about anything. Let's not get carried away.
Okay. Well, I got carried away. Look, you called me out. That's fair. But do you think that stands true, that you're obsessed with making?
Well, I've seen some wonderful films in my life, and I would love to leave behind me when I go some bits of work that give me what has been given to me by certain actresses and filmmakers. So I think I have quite a developed sense of what filmmaking is about, mm-hmm. and getting whatever's going on in the set is irrelevant, really. What only matters is on the film, on the screen. So that process of getting through the hellos and the joy and the arm holding and the kisses and the thing and the eating and the fun and the blah, 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 and the togetherness, is it getting onto the screen? Because there's a lot of delusion. Delusion.
I think delusion
goes on.
Yeah.
And people laughing at their own jokes and watching the rushes and thinking they're doing a brilliant thing. You have to be sort of cold-blooded lucidity you need to gather the bits to put them together in a film, is my opinion. So that side of me is rather clear on that. I can cut through all that other side, which is the fun stuff, and get to the point. I remember when I was doing Rich and Famous, which was a very difficult project for me, not because it wasn't a beautiful project, and I enjoyed doing it. And
well, you were also producing it.
I was a co-producer, but the process was full of conflict, and I just had to swallow and shut my mouth sometimes and just get on with it.
What was the conflict?
The conflict was really a sort of a power struggle, really, between my partner, the producer, and the fact that he had been unable to get the project going, and they'd come to me, and he'd been trying for about 5 years. And I was going through a period when I had a little bit of clout,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking for things that I could get involved in, reading a lot. And I think he was very threatened by me, because I was getting a lot of attention, and he was the actual producer, and I was just a co-producer. But with me and my clout of the time, and with Candy and everything, we got the film up. And I thought this was a very joyous combination thing of sharing everything, you know. And I didn't know that he was competitive with me, and it was very, very difficult. And it was a very growing up experience. And I got on okay with Kukor up to a point. He was very, very enamored of the material, as we all were. We were all delighted to use Gerald Ayer's phraseology, and he was the writer. It was wonderful that was doing that, but I've forgotten what the question was.
No, you answered it in a lot of
ways. Did I?
Yeah,
okay.
You did.
Okay.
I was interested, did you find that as your career sort of, you know, excelled and continued to grow, you know, later into the 70s and into the 80s, that sort of competitiveness that you're talking about, did you feel that amongst your peers?
I didn't use the word competitiveness. On the contrary, I don't think it's about being competitive at all.
No, not you. Sorry, your producer.
Oh, well, I think it was just plain jealousy. Mm. And I don't think he could help himself. He just had, I don't know, he didn't, or maybe I didn't. I tried to look at it and say, what was my part in this? How did I bring this situation to being such an unpleasant situation for myself? Did I participate? I always believe you've got to look at everything and say, how did I participate in this fight, not fight, whatever, or the good part, and look at the, try and be cold-blooded about it. And I really couldn't come up with an answer because I was goofy with pleasure, with enjoyment. I don't know. I don't think so.
What does that mean, goofy?
Goofy, like a little bit off, you know, in a sort of state of sort of happiness where you're a bit daft. You know what daft is? Uh-huh. A little bit, you know. No, I think it was a man-woman thing. I think it was the men business side of the boys' club and all that stuff. And I was a young woman, and there were very few actresses who were getting involved in production.
Right. And you had sort of entered this arena that...
Yes, and I think, you know, instead of being sort of good old Jackie, she's always a good sport, well, you know... There was a sense of, I don't know what it was. Anyway, whatever it is, I thought about it a great deal. And I would hate to repeat it. So whatever, if I haven't, that's why I've never really got involved in that capacity again. I thought, I can't, this is not good for me. Health-wise, it's not good for me. And I look at now, lots of people are doing this and very successfully. So maybe if I live long enough and if I get lucky with material and find something, maybe I'll get to do that again, but I rather doubt it. Because, like, you know, time is so time-consuming, and if you're living in stress, it's not good for you.
Yes, I heard there's a quote you have that I really love. It says, if you want to look good, you got to forgive.
I totally believe in forgiveness, yeah.
Where does that come from?
It's common sense.
Yes, it's common sense, but I guess I'm thinking for myself. It's hard sometimes to forgive, especially when the thing you're trying to forgive is painful or daunting.
Oh, no question. I guess no question. It takes time, but it's got to be, I think you need to make it on the top of the list as a thing to work towards rather than saying, I'm going to slay that M's.
You're allowed to curse on here, actually.
Yes, I am.
Yes, you're allowed.
I am.
You can okay. Say whatever you want.
Well, yeah, I don't need to. I think you've got the point. You've got to look for the flowers opening, you know. I don't know. Just... your body, you know, when you're acting, your body doesn't know what's going on. So you've got to... Often you take yourself into territory where you are angry or stressed or whatever, or you take your body there with you. He doesn't know. So after a really dangerously out there scene, you can get very messed up, and all that adrenaline and whatever that stuff is that's running in your body is running. And if you put the flowers first, I think you have a chance of being healthier, and not in a Pollyanna way. I don't mean it in a Pollyanna way. Just I do think. Well, obviously people who live a very long time and have aged well, they tend to glow from the inside. You see those kind of faces in countries like Greece, and incredible old faces that are just wonderful. And you say, they're strong, but they're generous, and their faces have a beauty. Mm-hmm. Not a cosmetic beauty, but a great beauty. And there's...
A beauty in character.
Yeah, I feel that. My father encouraged me to have character, and he aged well. He looked amazing. He wasn't that old, but he did look very interesting looking and handsome before he died.
I have a question about directors and your place in these movies, because I think a lot of people have done retrospectives of your work? I'm sure you are aware.
No, very few people have done retrospectives. They always get the same bloody movies out. It's always bullet, 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 and bullet. And I go, we've just had another anniversary. And I say, please, I had a tiny part in that. And
I have to say, know, Bullet, it's a fine movie.
No, but it just gets too much to get all this, you know.
I'm not even going to bring Bullet up here.
No.
It's not even on my... You can even look at my file.
No, okay.
I have nothing about Bullet here. I have this quote that I found of yours that is really, really wonderful. I thought was funny and insightful. You said, all directors are totalitarian people. Cukor, Polanski, Les Truffaut, but in his own way, he was quite precise. They were all older directors, and they were tough and totalitarian. It was always very intimidating. I want to go back.
Remember using the word totalitarian, but that's odd. I don't remember using that word, but autocratic. I would tend to say autocratic.
But you know what? We can change it with autocratic. Yeah. I don't even say totalitarian. So
I think it's autocratic.
Okay, we'll go back. Mm. I'll email the people who published this piece. I'll have them change it. Nevertheless, with all these directors, you worked with so many older men.
Yes.
And you were a younger woman at the time, and then just a woman in the world. Was it hard to find your voice on these sets? Was it hard to find your voice in these characters to claim some sort of autonomy?
Well, some of the projects, yes, some not. But I just learned, I just learned early that don't wait till you get to the set to ask 1,000 questions. You know, you do not have the ear of the director at that point. He's completely busy with stuff. He's busy directing traffic. He's busy doing all the horrible, mundane things of having to keep a film going, schedules and everything. And his mind is not open. So if you try and have the conversations before you get there, and if not, just go for it. Just do what you want to do. And don't ask, shall I do this or that? Because the guy can't
process
it in time, you know. So that's I learned early. So I just and often feel that one can work very well if you've got a good script. One can work very well almost without a director in terms of the acting. Of course, what happens when you put it together is another matter, and who's editing it and everything. But if you've got a well-written thing, it goes by itself. This question, I remember John Huston, he knew where to put the camera. That was a very, very key thing. He would actually leave the set sometimes where I did a thing called Under the Volcano. And I made the mistake once of saying to John Huston, in one scene towards the end of the film, I really felt I needed a close-up. There were very few close-ups. And I said to him, Mr. Huston, I really feel that you need to see what Yvonne is going through at this moment. And he said, and do you want to direct the picture too? And of course, I was slightly embarrassed. I said, no, but he looked at me like I didn't know if it was going to be a yes or a no. And he didn't do the close-up. And when I saw the film, I said, I didn't need the close-up. So that was an interesting. But with that came...
I like your accent, sort of reinterpreting his voice. I thought that was good.
But the combination of Huston and George Cukor, I learned a lot between the two. Basically, more than anything I had been attracted to before, which was the sort of Cassavetes type close-up, mm-hmm. Ingmar Bergman close-up, very, very extreme close-ups, and the skin being very much the forefront of the female persona, they pulled back and they didn't. They included the body in the way they shot. So there were scenes from Under the Volcano, there were scenes from Rich and Famous, particularly when I was in the New York part in the apartment, when I saw body language that I didn't know I was doing, and it just thrilled me.
Mm.
Because it said so much more than I had knew I was giving, and actually as I've learnt this, I've actually been on films where most actors are saying, "Can I have a close up?" I'm kind of going, "Could you back off? Could you back off?" And they're going, "What? I said, could you back off? I'd like you to see my hands. I'd like you to see, you know."
Right.
And they're really surprised. Because of course, also screens are getting bigger.
Right.
That's part of it too.
But you want the full body to see the whole...
Not the full body necessarily. Well, I don't necessarily
enough
need to...
give more than
enough
just...
To, yeah, but also to believe in your body and also to find the ease that you get when you start. Your hands are sort of, what the hell do I do with my hands? Can I have pockets in my outfit?
Well, I've thought about this the whole time because I have had my hands here, here, and I've noticed your hands...
Been fiddling with a bottle
You've
top.
Been fiddling, and I thought, well, maybe she's a little nervous or anxious or something, or maybe... It's just a thing she does. I wasn't really sure.
No, it's just my fingers tingle, which is why I do that.
They do.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting because body language says so much.
So much.
And yet most movies these days, it is like reverse shot coverage of your face here, their face mm-hmm. here. And there is no sense of time or space or...
There's quite a lot of that.
And they're missing it, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the material, on what you're doing, story you're telling. But this was about my own thing of having confidence, because for I was just like everybody else, you know, walking and talking at the same time was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds silly, but
no,
it's
sound silly.
It's just, and then one day you forget about your hands, and you don't need to have pockets in your or a handbag or a prop or something. You just are in the essence of where you are.
Was Under the Volcano the movie where you felt like you had confidence? As an actor?
No, I didn't have any particularly more confidence because John Huston used to not speak to me hardly at all. And the first few days he didn't speak to me at all. And I said to him one day, Mr. Huston, is everything all right? He said, yes, my dear, I'll tell you if it isn't. I said, okay. I would have liked to have had a pat on the back occasionally because it was a very macho world.
Mm-hmm.
There were virtually no women around.
He wasn't open to dialogue.
What he was when we went, before we went to start the film, I went to see him in Mexico, which was a very intimidating journey and a very intimidating moment, but I got through it. It's a long story. I don't think you have time for it. But
actually, we do have time
you do?
For it. Yeah, we do.
Well, the script for Under the Volcano had gone through torturous years of many, many people trying to write the script. I think, you know, a tremendous amount of years, I'm not sure. Anyway, finally they'd got the script. And... The script was, he was always working, everything had to be very linear. It was always right to the story, never, no fluff on the sides, no going into the little rivulets. It was the story, the story, the story.
Mm-hmm.
And my story was, I'd read the book, and she was virtually not in the book. And I said, this is a curious thing, because I'm playing somebody who is always in the eye of the drunk. I'm never really completely clear. He's always through his eyes anytime I'm there.
Mm.
It's through his desire or through his fog, alcoholic fog. So I've got to find a tone that brings me to be what I represent to him from the past, but also not to be too present because I'm never really, and it wasn't an easy tone.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to see him. I was a bit not happy with the script. And as I got onto the plane, I got delivered a script and I read it on the plane. When I got off the plane in Puerto Vallarta, I was met by a little boat and a person, a lady, and she said, get on the boat and we're going to go to the place where he lived, Las Caletas. We did the very bumpy trip to the thing. It was completely deserted. There was no one around. I was actually quite scared. She gave me a tuna fish sandwich, showed me to my room, which was a kind of part of a... There were various buildings... all empty, sort of large stone type floor, brick floor, painted wood, painted bricks with wire, just filling in the windows, gauze, not proper windows.
You have an impeccable memory.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I could draw it if I... and she said, I'm leaving the island, she said. She was his assistant. And she said, I'm going off and someone will contact you later. So I sat and I could hear the bugs creeping around and the crackling of the life in the jungle. And anyway, about 5 o'clock, a young woman came, a little Mexican girl came over and said, Mr. Huston's waiting for you, and he's in one of these compound buildings. And I had realized that he'd sorted out the problems of my script. So I didn't know what to talk to him about.
Life?
Well, no, I was just talking about, I was frightened and I didn't know, and he took me to this compound, and I'd been told that a big snake lived in there. So I was a bit nervous about this, that he had a pet snake. So this young woman who came sort of scurried scurried through the various paths up to this building, and there was John Huston, and we sat there, and I thought, crikey, what am I going to discuss with him? He solved all the problems in the script, because that was the reason I was both down. Yeah. Anyway, we started talking about alcoholism, and that was a really good subject, because God knows we all knew enough people, drunks and carry, you know, so that kept us really in good speech till about 8 o'clock, at which point I said, can I have a drink? Right. Absolutely. Was worn out with the anxiety. And we went from that compound, we went to another compound where this young lady who had come to meet me had prepared some food. And I had heard about John Huston's exotic lifestyle and love of glamour and wonderful food and everything. And I visited the larder, the food larder, which was full of cans of corn, tin pineapple, tin corn, white mayonnaise, at all the most ordinary food you've ever seen in your life, all in one place. And we had this extremely ordinary meal. And he was very pleasant. He was very pleasant. But I was in shock because I used to read about him living in this house in Ireland, you know, that he had this incredible lifestyle, very grand. And he told me about how he didn't have all his art anymore. He's given his paintings to one of his ex-wives or several of his ex-wives. And he seemed like a man who'd had it all, but really didn't relate particularly to all that physical stuff, those things anymore. And it was absolutely lovely. And then very shortly after it, he went off to his area, and I was left in that space. And suddenly the lights went off. I was actually in the larder at the time, and the lights went off. And I had to find my way back to the building that I was sleeping in. And it was totally nerve-wracking. And so now I wanted to go home at that point, but I had to go through till the next day and then another day. And I'm drifting with the story, but it was
something about it sticks into your head because you recall it with such detail.
I do. It was so. There were little creatures, you know, crossing the path all over the place, and I was really frightened. But he was wonderful in a way. And the next morning we went and we swam together. You know, and I'd been so frightened of him. When I first met him, I met him long, long, long before that. It was for some other film, and I was in London, and I went for an audition, and he was standing by the door of the Muse House where the auditions were to happen, and he turned and looked at me, and I said, oh, my God, this is a dangerous man. What a dangerous man, that smile. And that stayed with me. That it really definitely stayed with me, that he had power, he had legendary power and authority about him, and was very attractive too in a way, but the eyes did not warm up. The smile was there, but the eyes were still cool.
And they never did warm up?
They didn't really ever warm up, no, not with me. Never saw him. Well, it's not true, and I did see him sometimes talking to his children. He would sort of lean forward, he'd sit and then he'd lean forward and put his hands on his knees and talk to his daughter or... It was a fascinating, but it was a very male group.
Right.
And it was very, very, snobby also. It was all very grand journalists coming down. It was no riffraff. It was all sort of writers from top papers and everything. The whole thing was, and I thought, oh, I didn't know if I was happy to be there or not. I really didn't. I just really wanted to have a girlfriend to talk to. And I never got... I never got sick in Mexico. I was one of the few people who didn't get sick. So I just said, well, just drink more tequila.
You're very lucky.
And I did fine.
I get sick every time I go. since we only have, I guess, 6 minutes now.
Okay.
I have to ask some bigger questions.
Let's just mention Ashraf. Come on, let's get it.
I'm going to mention it in the intro and the... Yes, it's going to get properly plugged, I promise.
Okay.
In regards to your career... I'm looking at it as someone who doesn't know you very well.
Yeah.
We've known each other for 40 minutes now. I know throughout your work you have to be, you know, you're a caretaker for your mother.
And I was. She's no longer alive.
You were up until 1999, I believe. I guess just person to person, I'd like to know, how did you manage those things to work so hard, which you did, while still really having... to take care of this person who brought you here?
Well, you just work it out, you know, day by day. It was not easy. there were times when I would just be desperate, but because she was tricky. She was tricky, and she wasn't always kind. But she was always capricious. But she had a wonderful thing about it is that it taught me a tremendous amount about humanity and taught me patience, gave me a much more enhanced sense of humor, because there's considerable humor around the subject of dementia, even though it sounds rude to say so, but it's true, if you can take it right. And I think it's been a most brilliant journey to have gone on. It lasted 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 40 years she was ill. And it definitely enhanced my humanity. You know, people are now going through what I went through so young that many friends of mine now, their parents have either died or they're going through into dementia or goodness knows what. And you know, people are so panicked about it and how it overtakes the life and how difficult it is to look after. But sort of one day at a time. And the best thing you can do, of course, if you know somebody who's got this, who is a caretaker, is to offer them a day to look after, just to hang, let them get out of the house and go and sit with the person who's not well, and not be frightened of that, to do that, to keep an eye on somebody, give them some freedom, because that's the thing that I found the most difficult when I were times when I was completely on my own with my mother for days on end. And I mean, I had help at different times. Of course, I had to because I wasn't there. But there were many periods where I didn't have. And that's where you can help in that situation.
Mm. You have, I have to say, quite a remarkable clarity about you in a way that there's like your thoughts are so matter of fact and honest, and a sense that you have figured out something that I think a lot of us perhaps have not. Does that make any sense?
Well, I might be in a bit in advance on some of those subjects, but certainly not in others. I also had a moment. I had a transformative moment in my early life in 1972. I read a book, and it gave me the most extraordinary experience of seeing light and changing me. So I think I had a little bit of an enlightenment early on.
Mm.
I can't explain it any other way. And as I've talked to certain people about it, there's no question that I was a changed person when I read this book and I saw this light. I mean, like a transfiguration type thing, which sounds all very California and, you know.
No, it's,
but
sounds fine to me.
That combined with the other stuff. So I think maybe the book was about losing your ego, trying to lose the ego to reach. It was called The Mirror of Light by Rodney Collins. And I think it's out of print now, but it was very interesting.
Oh, as I'm writing it down.
Well, I don't know. I found it. It was a very, very old copy that I'd found in a French bookstore, the Shakespeare Company in Paris. It had been heavily underlined, and it was obviously vibrant. If you had photographed this book, it emanated this book. It was so full of vibes. Quite extraordinary. I sound nuts telling you this.
I don't think you sound nuts.
And then I gave it to a friend to borrow. Of course, I never got the book back. Devastated. I was devastated. Oh, and then I, years later, I found the new copy of the book in London, a shop. No vibes at all. Nothing. The book was just a piece of book.
It was zapped. They got, yeah, you didn't. It,
but
you
I put that moment
that.
As being a very key moment in my development.
Very broadly, you're 74 now?
Yes.
There's still lots of time to make really beautiful things that I suspect you will do. I'd like to know just today, right now, in this moment, how would you like to move forward? What do you want to do with the rest of your work?
Well, I'm working on something quite interesting. In fact, it's eating my Christmas period because I've got so much words to learn. I'm going to do a script with a young filmmaker. It's called Lauren and Rose. I'm playing Rose. And it's sort of, in a way, it's a two-part characters. There are other characters there, but it's basically the two people who talk in a restaurant, and they get to know each other very well. And it's really quite. I'm really enjoying the preparation. And I'm a little intimidated by the amount of things I have to say, because I get occasionally. I think, well, I remember the words and all that, but it's really exciting.
I have a feeling you're going to remember the words.
Well, I certainly plan on working hard at it.
I think you've done that your whole career.
Yes, but I've managed to avoid too many words. I've never been one to... I didn't love big roles.
Mm.
I've often done smaller roles. I like the world with mixed... I don't know what it is. I learned early on that I didn't particularly like being in every shot because I couldn't enjoy the work. It was just rush.
Mm.
So somewhere between an enormous role and a big role is what I like.
What was the Sidney Lumet quote?
He said, there's no such thing as a small role. There's just small actors. Is that the phrase?
That is.
Is it?
Yes.
There's no such thing as a small role. Well, in other words, it was a compliment. It was a compliment, meaning that I could make it into a decent role, which I quite honestly didn't feel I'd done at all when I saw the film. I thought it was a wasted remark.
Well, I have to say that that's a good closing sentiment because you are remarkably humble. You have a humility that I think most of us don't have.
I don't know. Okay, well, thank you.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Special thanks this week to Katrina Wan for asking us to do this episode. It was an absolute honor. If you'd like to see Asher, Jacqueline's latest film, you can do so in theaters and on demand now. We'll include more info about the film and Jacqueline at our website at www.talkeasypod.com. As we near the end of this year, we're going to promote some of our favorite conversations from 2018 on this podcast through social media. So you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Talk Easy Pod. You can also listen to the show now on Spotify. As always, it's on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you find your podcasts. The show is executive produced by David Chen, graphics by Ian Jones, illustrations by Krishna Shenoy. Our associate producer is Elliot Weintraub. Social media by Ian Chang, and the show is produced by Dylan Peck. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy, and I'll see you next week for one more episode with Keith David.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.